Welcome to Heads On's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences, and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse, and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage, and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. This episode, Safer, Weller, Happier, explores the richness and diversity of mental health recovery in all its many shapes and forms. In this episode, we share people's experiences of what recovery looks and feels like for them, the things that help and the things that hinder. From regaining independence to building confidence, reconnecting with others, or learning to live alongside distress. Recovery takes many forms, each account as personal as the things that bring people to mental health services for help. We celebrate here the achievements of everyone who has ever struggled with their mental health, bringing hope for the future, no matter how challenging the journey might be.
Yeah, we're very lucky to live in a seaside town, to have the sea so close, to have the hills so close, and being in nature is absolutely at the core foundation of maintaining a sense of stability and a sense of lightness in the world through kind of constantly sort of, you know, I'm navigating mental kind of avenues that are pretty dark and difficult on a daily basis, but getting out into the countryside and going down to the sea and just being with nature, being with the elements, being in the elements is very powerful and very sustaining. And my art practice is really the key thing that kind of helps me to regulate my mental health, my kind of sense of well-being.
You've probably heard of the five ways to well-being. CLANG, I use the estimate. Connect, learn, be active, notice things, and giving. And as a volunteer, Sitton's advice, I was connecting because I was meeting all these people. I was learning because I had to learn loads of legal stuff and all the rest of it. I was active because I hadn't got there. I had to notice things because of the reactions of people. And I was giving because I was being a volunteer. I'd never heard of the five ways to well-being, but there I was doing it all. And no wonder it helped me. There's no doubt that improved my confidence. It improved my getting out and was very good for me. I could just as easily have had 7 duvet days a week. And there were certainly days, you know, I first stopped working, when it was a bit like that. I would try and set myself to do something during the day, you know, vacuum one room. And that was about all I could manage in a day. I manage a lot more than that now.
Until someone's ready, that has some hope, until they're ready to kind of believe that there could be something better, it's very difficult, but we can hold it for them until they find it. And that's very important. But I think trust as well, like actually gradually allowing people to do more, even though they might hurt themselves, is very, very important. Really taking some risks with them and knowing that it's their choice, ultimately.
I love it when somebody's getting better, and it may not be anything you've done. It may be they've decided they're going to take control and sort themselves out. And that's great when they do that, because you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink, can you? And so when that person decides they're going to take on board and do things for themselves, I think it's great. See, you didn't really need me.
Through occupational health, I was offered 6 months of EMDR therapy for trauma, which was just amazing. We had to do like resource installation, so I had to get a safe space, a safe person, safe animal in my head, like places to go, which was quite challenging for me. And it's like a fantastic journey in there now that I can go on when I'm not feeling great. Then we targeted, so I chose 5 trauma memories that were very strongly linked to different events. So we started working on one. I would talk about what was going on, what I was feeling at the time, and then I'd have to sort of close my eyes and the therapist would tap with me, and then, you know, I'd feel all sorts of stuff and end up quite a pickle, really. We did that for each specific trauma memory, and for a few months after, my brain was still reprocessing. And it's hard to explain, but after that, I still have the memories, but they're memories. They're not flashbacks anymore. So something might pop in my head, but it's just gone straight away. That was amazing. I'm going to have another stint when I'm ready.
Some things we need to go back to, and I can think back to the old model of care, head in the hospital days, where patients would have more activities during the day. They would go out to work. They'd go out to work at the farm, they'd go out to work at the workshops, the occupational therapy, the laundry, the kitchen, the nurseries, the gardens. We don't have that for our patients now. So whilst we have good medication and treatment plans and psychology, etc., etc., in terms of getting people motivated out of bed, we don't have that as much. And that's probably the sad thing. Whilst we try and endeavour to keep our patients occupied, it's not, some of it's not real life.
My life now is not really a life, it's a half life. I function, I don't know how to describe my life at the moment. My life, I have to say, my art became more and more important to me. I've also am emerging from this depression, and I really am still emerging into a world that has gone completely mad. So before I became depressed, the world was far from perfect, but watching children being murdered on television was not a national pastime. And it feels like I'm now in a world where everything's gone mad and the world is able to turn away from some of the most awful things that are happening. It's having a massive impact on me. And even some days I don't feel even able to get out of bed, which is when I started doing some of the mixed media pieces that I've been doing more recently, which is using photos of some of my paper work. So paintings that I've done, or watercolour that I've done, or acrylic that I've done, or gel prints that I've done in the real world, I have photos of those, and then I put them together in a collage, but on the iPad.
It can feel quite trivial, but the recovery was waking up every day, having breakfast, watching TV, making lunch, trying to leave the house, trying to see a friend, and going to sleep. Doing all of that is so hard. I remember the time often saying, like, I'm not doing anything, and my housemates coming to me and say, don't you dare, you're doing more than any of us. Recovering is hard work. Recovery is silent work. People don't recognize. It's just hidden. You see that I wake up, but you don't see how hard it is to wake up. You see that I have groceries in my fridge. You don't know how hard it has been for me to plan the fact that I'm gonna have groceries in my fridge. You see me going to a friend's, you know how hard it is to listen to the friend for like 15 minutes, let alone speak for an hour and a half, not knowing what to say because I have nothing in my life right now. So it's such a hard thing, trying to get motivation, trying to find joy again, just to try and find yourself and who you will become.
The word recovery was never really used. It wasn't a word that we talked about. Well, people don't recover. You can't recover. You can't recover from a mental illness. That's what they used to say. I did quite a lot of work with some of the groups that were very critical of mental health services. Mad Pride was an incredible organisation in the 90s, and I met the guys who ran Mad Pride. I brought some of them down to Brighton to talk with staff. Most of my colleagues thought I'd gone completely bonkers. In my last 2 years of my career, I rewrote the whole of our care programme approach document. I had a group of service users who were quite radical. We sat together and we focused on this stuff. We rewrote the whole thing. I knew it was never going to get accepted, and we got rid of all those words. We used people, person. We made the whole thing person-centred. It was all built on the idea that what recovery meant was people recovering things that they'd lost, recovering their identity, recovering their world. And in some cases, that was a new world that they hadn't had before.
It actually felt like there were things happening there on some level to make people, well, to support people in some way and try and bring something and make them better in some way. So there was a programme of activities. There was at least one thing a day, like arts type group, mindfulness. There was something I did engage with, and actually my psychologist said that something that was good or new for me is that I did seem to make connections with the other patients and was sort of developed more socially in terms of being able to speak, because before I wouldn't speak in a group setting or anything. And there was definitely something that clicked there, like they had, that it helps me to have time outside and time off the ward would be important, and they were like escorting me to go outside. They were just kind, I think, and there were sort of particular individuals that made it, still sort of stays with me now, the difference that they made.
I was a nursing assistant and I worked in a psychiatric ward for 2 years, and I met one person that had pure psychosis, and I never forgot her. And I didn't forget her because she used to wander up and down the corridor almost like a ghost, looking terrified and like she was in another place, and she barely spoke. And then when she was due to be discharged, she came and sat next to me and spoke to me about her experience, and she was incredibly articulate. She had 3 kids, she had a normal life, and I just remember thinking, blimey! I think because I've seen people mentally ill who are still mentally ill when they leave hospital, but she was just completely functional, as she appeared to be.
I was so glad to get out, but all of a sudden I had this situation where I wasn't working. I didn't know how benefits worked, so I was sort of going along. I applied for stuff because I had to. I applied for jobs, but it's very difficult to explain away a month of your life being on section in a mental health hospital and at my age. I ended up helping a friend of mine who was building an extension down in Southampton, and I was doing labouring, which I'd never done in my life, and it was really hard work, for about £70 a day. But it was just literally until I got to a point where I found that I could get certain benefits. Once I got into those, I could sort of breathe again. I went into voluntary work, conservation work. So it's called the Green Gym, an offshoot of the BTCV, British Trust for Conservation Volunteers. Now, the idea of the Green Gym is to help people with physical and mental health issues, helping them back into sort of normality, if you like. So it contributes to that. So I spent about 6 years there, So I really enjoyed it. It was really good because you're out in nature. You were able to sort of like clear your head. So you could focus, which you have to do, of course, at times in your life. So that was really useful. Got to know people through that as well. And to a point where I was helping other people.
The thing I learned most personally is truth. When I say truth, is being open about what you're going through. Don't make a judgment that people will not receive it. And without truth, you will suffer a lot. And also without truth, your recovery journey will be quite prolonged. And without truth, you don't get the support that you deserve. So for me, truth in terms of openness, what you're going through, that's what I would advise anyone who is having challenges in life. So be truthful about it. Sometimes it doesn't land well. You face resistance, you face judgment. However, it's something you have to take bravely and do.
I often draw when I'm unwell, but I write as well. I suppose I'm an artist, I do sell my work. To be honest, often when I start a project, I'm hypermanic. And it just happens that way, and then it just carries on. Sometimes it can carry on for a year. I'm not high the whole time, but I'm kind of on a roll. And then it comes to the point where I'm exhibiting, and then it falls flat for a while, and then before I pick up on a new project. My artwork kind of changes a lot. One minute I'm working in an abstract way, and then I'm working in a more realistic way. So, and I'm always experimenting with different materials. I think there is a kind of novelty-seeking aspect to it, but also experimental, adventurous. I was going to say it keeps me alive. I think it does.
I think some of the work around honouring emotions through the therapeutic work that I've done, to a degree through meditation practices, that has allowed me to value but not be afraid of strong emotions and the need for us to be present to what is difficult in us and to know that that's healthy for patients. They just need to know it's okay and how we hold that for them. There's a tuning in to a journey that is a natural healing process that is in kids. They cry, they go through experiences rather than stay stuck on them, that I feel I can appreciate for patients. Even if they're on medication, that still continues, that other being fully human.
For most of my life, I've been very uncomfortable in my own skin. I wouldn't say now I'm totally comfortable, but I'm an awful lot more comfortable than I used to be. There was one chapter I wrote for a recovery book that sort of talked about how I'd gone from being the wee timorous beastie that was the mouse of Rabbi Burns to becoming a reaper cheep, like the mouse from Narnia waving the rapier around. And I still sort of have that sense that I'm a bit of a mouse, but a mouse that found her voice. When you're in the dark hole, it's very hard to see any light at the end of any tunnels. Just feels like there's been a rock fall and it's barricaded and you can't get out. But if you believe in other people and people feel believed in, it doesn't half help. For years I ran on that borrowed confidence. Everybody else thinks I can do this, so I'd better get on and do it. I'm not going to let them down. I'm not sure that I need to borrow that now, which is quite encouraging.
We challenge the diagnosis. We help people to develop an understanding of what the diagnosis actually means. We do a lot of work about trying to capture people early, do a lot of outreach work, trying to pick up people early so they don't end up on that journey of in and out A&E, in and out A&E, on the wards. And also to try and catch people so they understand their diagnosis early and what that means and how it might impact. We try and involve families. It's quite inspirational, really. When you're in it day in, day out, you can perhaps lose a sense of that. But we've had clients that have moved on from here. In fact, I was out there today and somebody came back. They were here 11 years ago. It's about 11 years old, the service. And they're now out teaching. They're teaching around mental health. They're doing co-training with staff from here. So I just looked round and they were there and I went, oh, She went, I'm doing really well. This is someone who was very stuck in services, really stuck, but they did the treatment here. They didn't want to leave. It was really, really painful, but they're out there as a recovery worker, but also a trainer, but teaching qualification. So it can happen.
I think there's a huge need still for user-led organisations and initiatives where there's that authentic sharing of experience and mutual support. I've always believed we should be allies of mental health services, not them against us.
We ended up having a Zoom appointment. He felt very strongly, I think, that I wasn't making sufficient progress, and so he added in an additional medication. They call it the golden bullet or something. It would appear that I am particularly responsive to this mirtazapine, although I then had another week of just sheer hell of side effects. And I have to say, I am finding the side effects of this medication not very nice, but there's no doubt that it's helped my mental health and that I am now much more verbal. And as you see me, there are still lots of things I struggle with, and I'm still certainly not functioning, but I'm now as I am now, and that is because of the mirtazapine. And then I was offered a course of trauma-based CBT, and that has been fantastic, and that's been very helpful. And I would say that it's been, of all the therapy that I've had over the years, but maybe partly because I was ready, it's been the most useful therapy that I've ever had.
One of the key ways that I've been able to cope from having had such a difficult and disturbing childhood, and indeed sort of ongoing through my adolescence and through my 20s in particular, has been different talking therapies. I've glutted out on talking therapies in many respects. One of the key things for me about the importance of talking therapies is just really having space to be able to talk about experiences that you can't talk about anywhere else because it's so taboo. But with talking therapy, you have a space to, at least for the time that you're kind of in that situation, to be listened to. I've had some exceptionally good experiences of talking therapies. The cognitive behavioural therapy that I got through the NHS Trust in 2023 was very, very powerful and effective. And that particular sort of kind of therapy, you're not perhaps focusing on past trauma in such a deep way, but you're certainly focusing on the impact of past trauma and how it affects you in the moment, in the current moment. Various models that those therapies have for helping you to understand how trauma kind of impacts on negative thinking, and how, you know, negative thought patterns then kind of create a template, as it were, for future ways of thinking. And it was very helpful in helping me to unpick that to some extent.
My favourite thing about my job is when, and it happened a few times now, when someone I've worked with has gone on to become a peer and work for the Trust, and we call it peer spawning. I went to a peer conference in Brighton a few weeks ago with two peer colleagues from other services, and I was outside sort of having a sneaky cigarette on a break, and there's someone screaming my name and running. Oh, like, oh. And it was this lady who I'd worked with, and now, yeah, I've met her as a colleague, and she said, I'm only here because of this woman. And she's just like, oh, she said, I want to be that person for someone. And later in the day, she was that person for someone.
I'm
proud of the people that I work with. And when I say people, I'm talking about people that I've cared for as well as people that I work with. I'm proud of people because we all come to work to do the right thing for people that we care for. And I'm really proud of the people that I have worked with on their journey. You know, like the other day, I was talking to one of our experts by experience, and, you know, I nursed him 25 years ago. I'm really proud of the fact that he's sitting alongside me and helping design and work on this big project, and is doing amazing considering how he was 25 years ago when he was really very, very unwell.
I think what's really nice is when people, you don't see people again, that sounds terrible, but actually when you've worked somewhere for a long period of time, the fact that you haven't, that they've perhaps come back once in that time because they, you know, they've relapsed and stuff, but you haven't seen them again, that actually you hope that they've gone on and, you know, been able to live, you know, a safer, weller, happier life, you know, the life they wanted for themselves.
This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together, and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories, and to the many staff, volunteers, and project partners who have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. Oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.